Intertextual Cardboard Experience.
Hello and welcome to Intertextual Cardboard Experience, a podcast that's hopefully always learning as I'm doing it, and our tutorial-tastic 26th guest, Jonathan Cox. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. The audience is kind of catching us like mid conversation as we've been talking for a minute. So
we should turn the recorder on. We're just talking about all sorts of stuff.
I know. I should have just done it from the beginning, but then you'd been like, wait, what? You didn't warn me. But no, it's been good. And honestly, yeah, some of those things that we've been talking about, I think will sneak their way into here. But just kind of a little bit of a note on the podcast format in general. I'll just have like a couple of intro questions. Then we'll talk about some things that are kind of specific to you, and I'll try to make as much sense as we go. And there's a little twist, maybe. We'll see. But the first question, and this is kind of like a slight tweak to my regular initial question, is, you know, what's a game or gaming memory that made you fall in love with board games?
That's a great question. I mean, I've really enjoyed games since I was a kid. I mean, a lot of us are like that for sure. Like I have fond memories of playing The Amazing Labyrinth and Can't Stop and whatnot when I was like 6, 7, 8 years old. But I also have memories of desperately trying to get my sister and my to play these games with me, and she would sometimes, but like my parents, like they would sometimes. My mom taught me chess when I was probably like 7 or 8, but like I did not come from a gaming household at all, so a lot of my memories of those is like seeing board games and wanting to play them. I became addicted to I became addicted to video games, like, you know, in my teenage years and stuff. I wanted to design them and all that kind of stuff. And it didn't come around to board games again, really, until I was in my late 20s. And I think that is probably the memory that I actually like to share, because it's interesting how your life can so pivotally change in a moment. And I was working a job, and a coworker who was friendly, but I wouldn't say we were friends, a coworker invited me to a party at his friend's house. And I was like, sure, I don't have that many friends, let's go for it. And when I was there, I met these people, and they were talking about Settlers of Catan. And I was like, oh, I've heard of that for years, you know, just off and on, just through media and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, you should join us. And I was like, oh, okay, that sounds great. And I just kept hanging out. And at like 1 or 2:30 in the morning, everyone in the party had left except for the two people who started this party, and we were just getting along so well. And they're like, hey, you want to learn Liar's Dice? And I was like, sure, I've never heard of that before. And so I was sitting there playing Liar's Dice at like 2 o'clock in the morning at this house of people that I just met like a few hours before. And I remember when the last person that wasn't me left, I was like, do you want me to leave? And they're like, no, hang out. And that was just such a welcoming situation, and we had a blast. Obviously, I think I got home at like 3:30 in the morning, and in a lot of ways that day changed my life. You know, I joined their first I guess first for me Settlers of Catan game probably a week later, fell in love with that, played with them weekly for a year, and you know, the rest is kind of history. But you know, I'm like, I'm so glad I said yes to going to that party.
Awesome. So you're channel has existed for over 10 years now.
Just a bit. Yeah, I started John Gets Games in 2013. Okay. April 14th, I think.
Nice.
Yeah, something like that. So, and it's crazy. It's just crazy. Like, you know, 10 years rolled around, and it was like, I remember 9 years ago thinking, there's no way I'm going to be doing this 5 years from now, let alone 10.
So when did that that event of like meeting the coworker and playing those games happen in relation to the start of your channel? What sort of like time breakdown?
Oh, years and years. That pivotal party was March-ish 2008.
Okay.
And I started John Gets Games in 2013. But I've been kind of wanting to do more in board games for a couple of years at that point, actually. You know, I fell in love with board games in 2008, 2009. 2009 is when I found a meetup.com group that was an hour away from me, and I drove an hour there and an hour back 2 to 3 times a week for like a year before I just moved down to be closer to this group. And you know, in around 2011, 2010, I started tinkering with game design because I just wanted to do stuff. I found that it's very difficult to design games. And in 2012, actually, some of my best friends had a gaming podcast that was about video games and technology and gadgets and stuff like that. And every time I'd visit them, they live 500 miles away, they'd be like, "Let's have you on as a guest. Like, you'll just be the board game like guest. Like, every X episodes, we'll talk about board games." And so that was my first experience making board game content, quote unquote, was just, you know, talking into a microphone at my friend's house on their geeky podcast. And I remember the first one, I just went off on Suburbia and how awesome that game was. And I distinctly remember after doing a couple of these thinking, maybe I should start a podcast. Like, that sounds like fun. I have a lot to say. And I'm not exactly sure why I decided to go for YouTube over podcasting. You know, I might regret it in some ways. I might not. It definitely is an interesting fork. So yeah, it was kind of a slow, gradual process to turning on the camera and actually creating a YouTube channel.
Nice. Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, it seems like that the first video that you did create, the first tutorial video, was kind of just created on a whim. Like you'd been in the space, and then all of a sudden it's like, I'm just going to make this video.
Yeah, it was a review of Tuluva. All my videos were reviews at the very
Reviews. Okay.
beginning. Because I just was very opinionated about these games. And I remember thinking, what should I start with? And I was like, oh, I know, a game I've played 30 plus times that I love. So yeah, I just kind of jumped into it. And when I woke up that morning, I did not know I was starting a YouTube channel. Even though it'd been sort of on my mind to do something for some time.
Oh, that's awesome. So how long were you doing reviews before you kind of started transitioning to tutorial, and how much like overlap was there until you kind of started like off reviews? I know you're still doing
Oh,
podcasting and like talking about, games
yeah.
in that context, of course. So like
There's a lot of overlap.
there's
One mantra that I've tried to have is to change when I need to. And, you know, it was a very, I did a lot of soul searching in, what was it, 2018, when I decided to stop making reviews. So I was making reviews for about 5 years. And I did my first playthrough video, I think, in late 2013. So like maybe like 5, 6 months in, I was probably like my 10th or 12th video. I was putting out like one or two videos a month, because, you know, it was just a hobby thing that I was just tinkering along with. I actually remember I made my first playthrough video. It was for a game called, ooh, Progress, something about invention of civilization. Gosh, I don't remember the details of it, but I remember I couldn't get it played. Like, I read the rules and I was just not getting it played at game nights. And I was like, how hard can it be to do a playthrough? I'm just going to turn the camera on and give it a go. It turns out it's not easy. But for some reason, I kept doing it.
Oh, nice. Okay, that's actually like a pretty good kind of like transition to like another thought. I think, well, and it's funny that you mentioned, you stopped reviews around 2018. And that's, if I'm gonna like timeline my time in the hobby space and when like I've seen your work, it's probably around like 2017, 2018. Had the earlier memories of playing board games as a kid, and probably a similar time at about like 2007, 2008 with Catan, and actually did play a decent amount of like card games with some of my friends in high school too, which was a cool thing that I can look back on as well. But
I did too. It was just called Magic the
I'm kind of that's it's not like 100% blind spot because I've like looked at Magic. I've done some of the digital things, but most of my experience in like those types of card games is all in the digital format. So like a Hearthstone, which obviously is not
Sure.
like 100% the same, or
It's pretty darn similar. I mean, Hearthstone is a incredible game for sure. Yeah, I definitely, I just kind of glossed over like, oh, I fell into video games. But yeah, I in 2020, in like 2000, No, not even 2000. It's like 1999. I fell into Magic the Gathering somehow, and you know, I was the nerdy kid who played Magic in the science lab with my friends at lunch most days for a couple of years in high school. It was great times. I still have most of my Magic cards in a box in the garage somewhere. I should really crack those open, considering they're like, geez, like 24 years old now.
Yeah, maybe you've got some value in there too.
It's possible. I don't really do deck construction kind of games anymore. I'm kind of tangenting right here, but I loved it at the time. Like I can get like near obsessive about the things that I really care about. And you know, there was a time in like 2001 where I knew every Magic card. I mean, there's a lot more now. Obviously, the game was only like 8 years old at the time, but like I knew every single card. You asked me a card, I could tell you the mana cost, I could tell you the effect that it did, I could tell you the release that it came out in. I was just incredibly into it, and I played online a fair amount. There was a free piece of software that you could play. You could deck build with any cards, and you could play with people online if you shared your IP address. So we did quite a bit of that back then. My big joy in that game was figuring out how to counteract the meta of our group, which is kind of cool. Like I never did any tournament scenes or anything like that, but we had a meta that we had like 15 people when we played every day in science class. And you just know that, you know, Scott has the dragon deck because he spends a lot more money on his cards than I do. And, you know, most of my cards I got in like 200 to 300 lumps from eBay. Like, you know, pay $40, get 300 cards that are probably all commons. And I really enjoyed trying to counteract that. Like, I remember I put together a Rat Pestilence deck, which was all common cards, just to compete with my friend's like $200 or $300 dragon deck. And that felt really good. I mean, it lost to like everything else, but specifically that felt really good to pull off. And I really enjoyed those kind of things for sure.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I one of the things, like some of the conversations and whatnot that I've had with friends, like I said, I only did like the digital ones, so like Hearthstone or Runeterra, or the most recent one was Marvel Snap, which is even simpler, but nonetheless is just like kind of creating those counter meme type of decks. It's like I'm going to build around this card. Let's see how far we're taking this thing.
My rat deck only worked because it was a black white deck, which is not what's supposed to happen. And I still remember the combo after 24 years. I can't remember all the details, but there was like a pariah card you put on the rat, which means the rat took all the damage coming in. And then there was like an invulnerability white magic spell you could put on there so that all the damage was negated. And then I would play Pestilence, which does one damage to literally everything, but all the damage was being funneled into this rat that couldn't take damage. It felt good when you pulled it off, but you know, it wasn't every game.
Oh, that's good stuff. Yeah, I think some of my timelining, yeah, basically just, you know, my first experience with you and the majority of like what I've like seen and listened to from you is in your tutorial space. So
Yeah. I
I
mean, that's where
knowing.
most of my videos have been. I think I made around 100 reviews before I stopped. And I've made hundreds of tutorials now. It really
Yeah.
adds up when you keep doing it.
So yeah, and you know, obviously I think there are different types or different formats that kind of like work for different people when it comes to tutorials. And you know, I think in general there are so many different ways in which people can learn games or attempt to learn games too. And you know, you'll get some people that like will say they won't watch videos at all, or you'll get all across the board. But I
Sure.
guess what made you kind of like land on or play around with the learn while playing format?
It's pretty simple. I made the videos that I wanted to see. And that's kind of like the first piece of advice that's given about content creation in general. Like, you know, find a niche and fill it, make the thing that you want. And that's what I did with my reviews, where I was like bullet point by bullet point, really trying to be, you know, specific about various things, talk about player count, things that I just generally didn't feel like I was seeing consistently in the review space. I made the reviews that I wished I could watch other people make. And the same thing went with the playthroughs because I enjoyed feeling like I played the game. And the best way to know how to play a game, like mechanically, not strategically, but mechanically, is to play it. And the number of times that I have read a rule book and I'm just like, okay, we'll see how this works. And then you start playing and you're like, oh, I get it now. That clicks into that click. I mean, I just played a game. I won't go into the details of it, but I just played a game last week where I read through the rules and I was interested in trying it. We put it on the table and we played it. And I remember at the very beginning saying, I think buildings are the key to this game, but I don't really know. And the game ended. We're like, holy cow, buildings are the key to this game. Like, it's where you get most of your points. And it's like, okay, well, I know that now. And next time I play, I'm going to keep that even more in mind. And so the goal that I've always had, it's evolved over time for sure, but the goal that I've had with my playthrough videos is I want people who watch it to feel like when they play it for the first time, they've actually played it before. That they're playing it for the second time, essentially. I shortcut essentially that first play, and you don't even need the front-loaded rules teacher. You could just kind of work your way through. I will say, and I should really go back and watch some of my earlier videos because my videos have gotten longer and longer over time. I remember the first time I crossed an hour, thinking, "Oh my gosh, nobody's going to watch this. This is crazy." I think it was a game called XenoShift Onslaught, which was this cooperative deck building game, and I remember thinking like, gosh, this is gargantuan. Nobody's gonna watch this. It's like an hour and 15 minutes long, and my scythe video went like an hour and 10 minutes long, and I just felt so guilty about it. And now, like, I just filmed a video for Dominion. It's gonna be coming out soon, and it's an hour long, and I didn't even play the whole game. I played like half of the game in an hour. So my format has obviously changed. Like, I think, when I first started this, I just played the game. Like, the person does this, this person does that, this person does this, this person does that. And now I talk about a lot more, like the headspace and everything. And I think, again, that's the kind of stuff that I want to see. It takes more time. And I know that it kind of hurts my channel's growth. Unfortunately, it's something I fully understand, that longer the video is, the less likely people are to click on the link. But I also get comments all the time, like, I never thought I'd watch this whole thing, but I did, and that sort of thing. So it's not necessarily the best business strategy, but I think it's the best way to actually learn a game. Whenever I personally watch a video that's just strict instructions, like a 22-minute long video that essentially explains the rule book with examples and stuff, I get to the end of the video and I just don't know how to play the game because I didn't really see how it all connected. I could have just read the rule book, and that's not a slight on that kind of video. That's just how my brain works. Whereas if I watch somebody play through a game, or at least even just a few rounds, I mean, like, Rado was the inspiration for me to start making my videos, and I still watch his videos. I am much more focused on accuracy, whereas he's very focused on feel of the game. Like, that's his priority for sure. But that's still a really big deal, and it's just a really good way to know, I guess. And in a lot of ways, I've tried to differentiate myself. I didn't want to become Rado 2 or anything like that. And my differentiation was, I'm really going to go detailed on the rules, try to make this as accurate as possible, which makes it longer, which makes it more of a teach than a experience the joy of this game and what you're playing and how it all goes together. It's just different niches. And that's what I like. I enjoy learning things when it matters, because I guess that's my biggest problem when I watch a video that just is a strict rules teach. 15 minutes in, they reference something they talked about 2 minutes in, and I don't remember what it was because I wasn't able to stitch it into something else. I know a lot of people, it works very well, but honestly, I've read thousands of rule books. The best way for me to learn is actually just reading a rule book. Usually I start watching a video and I'm like, ah, I'm just going to find the rule book and read it, and then I'll understand it better.
Yeah, for certain. Yeah, like I mean, yeah, you kind of mentioned it. People definitely will learn in different ways, and I think in general, yeah, I don't think I've read thousands of rule books. I know I haven't. I've read hundreds. That's for sure. And yeah, I can digest them and usually piece the game together like pretty well in my head. But I don't know. Maybe sometimes my brain space for the reading isn't good, or maybe sometimes it's like I'm doing some dishes and this game is going to be simple enough to for watching like a 15-minute video might give me enough tips to be able to start it up quicker. Or hanging out with you for like an hour is going to be the thing that I want to do. And honestly, like It is funny. I mean, you've definitely done a lot of tutorials, and I've watched a lot of tutorials of yours for games that I have owned or do own, have owned and have played. But I think I also just find myself clicking on games that I'm like I think you mentioned it earlier, that I'm interested in playing and kind of want to have that experience, even if I know that I'm probably not going to have it, because you just sit down. And it's just very conversational. It's very welcoming. It's like me hanging out at the table, just like playing the game through you. And it's like, okay, this is relaxing. And then all of a sudden, like sometimes in that setting, I know that I'm not like trying to digest the rules, because I know I'm not going to play the game maybe ever for that matter. But it's that experience, and I'm like, oh, this is great.
Yeah, hey, that's definitely what I'm aiming for. Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, when you sit down to play a game, you can't learn while you play. You need to know the rules, and you need a rules teach, and then you get into it. And so it's kind of an unusual space to just kind of, just sit back. Don't worry, you're not going to make any decisions. You're watching a video. You can't actually change any of this stuff. I'll make the decisions for you, and you just kind of stitch it together. Yeah. And it's when I make these, I'm very focused on the order in which things are taught, which is why it's actually tough. Like, I frequently get comments asking like what the game is like, what'd you like about this game, or what'd you feel about it? And I don't know. It's interesting. Like, I have a very similar experience to the viewer, where to a certain extent, I didn't play the game either. I stack the deck, I roll the dice till I get the right result, I make mistakes intentionally, usually, so that I can, show what happens when you take damage or fall off the cliff, or don't have enough, wood to do this. And if there's a 2-to-1 conversion, I better make sure that I need to actually do that 2-to-1 conversion. And if there's healing, then I better make sure I take damage so that I can teach that. And ultimately, it means I didn't play the game either. Especially considering I usually don't play through the whole game. It's like, it's going to be a very different experience when you're competing, because most of these are competitive. It's gonna be a very different experience when you're doing that, because sometimes it'll be late in the game before you ever get around to X ability, or maybe you just never actually, get around to doing something like the sabotage action in whatever game it is, and that's not ideal if you're teaching that experience. Yeah, I try to force it essentially, and yeah, so it's in some ways it's inauthentic, and I get that, but you have to decide on your focus, and I decided my focus was teaching first, experience second, essentially. Yeah. Also, it's hard for me to give the overall experience, because I have almost never actually played these games before I film it. So I'm not even sure what it's gonna feel like with other people around the table. I just kind of, wing it, essentially.
Huh, yeah, that's I mean it makes from like your creation side and your goal standpoint and everything, like yeah, that makes complete sense to me. And you're saying that, I don't know, but like I do, and I just said it, so I don't want to be like ridiculously redundant or anything, but yeah, I don't know, it having every scenario that like kind of could pop up, everything that you know that you need to address and like stack the deck in order to make that happen, like that's what you have to do, like you're covering the rules, like you're making it as complete and exhaustive as you can. But yeah, I mean obviously you've done it like to the point where you have like a ton of people who are watching this who I think for very similar reasons as myself are just like enjoying these videos and hanging out with you, and I don't know,
The
I
number of
like it.
people have told me that they fall asleep to listening to my videos is surprisingly high, and they say don't take offense, and I don't. I
Okay,
don't, but apparently that's a thing.
well, you have like a very like calming presence, so so I think I would take that as a compliment,
Yeah.
You've made them relax, but I can't. Like I said, I want the 98% of my YouTube watching is doing dishes, and sometimes I take longer doing dishes because of that. But if I were to fall asleep doing that, I don't know, I could have like a knife through my wrist or something. So awesome. Okay, I had some other questions here. I'll bop them down. So this is the twist or the gimmick or something, but. The last I think overarching question that I had was you deciding upon the learn while playing format. So I've got two questions here, and I'll just read them. I'll read one of them. So I want you to think of three activities that you feel would lend themselves well to a learn while doing style of tutorial. It could exist, but like what are three other activities that you feel kind of the learn while doing style of tutorial would work well for?
I mean, just in general,
In
as a
general,
general concept. I mean,
literally anything like.
the first one that pops into my head is like riding a bike. Like, you can't be told how to ride a bike. You just have to do it. And you might, fail at it a decent amount before you do. But like, I think that, physical type things where you have to like map things to your hand, like, learning to play an instrument. You can understand music theory, and yet your fingers don't do the right thing until you do it, as you actually do it. And I know a lot of people don't learn the music theory. They just kind of figure it out as they go, and make interesting music without even understanding the reasons why. I say that I'm not a musician. I've struggled every time I've tried, but that's definitely not been a something that's come easy to me. But as far as other things, yeah, as far as like where you use your brain primarily, it's a bit of a cop out, but my other thought is work. When you have like a piece of software or something like that, you just have to get into it. I edit my videos with Final Cut Pro, and I did not take a class in how to do it. I just kind of started. I just clicked on the buttons and kind of figured it out as I went, and then started, asking questions as I went along. But I think, I guess creating things requires you to create them. Learning how to make something is very different than just doing it and then iterating and figuring out where the tough parts are, essentially.
Okay, so there's a part two to this now. So you've got yourself in a trap, all right? So we've got a hypothetical situation. For unknown reasons, you have to stop your channel. You can no longer make learn while playing videos for board games, and you have to shift your focus to one of the three things that you just mentioned. So biking tutorials, music tutorials, or creating work. We'll say like software, learning software will be like third one, 'cause I like that. That makes sense. That's kind of something that I've done in the past. And you have to make videos on one of those three. Which one of those three is your new career?
I mean, it would certainly be, teaching software and teaching the use of technology and whatnot. I've actually done a little bit of this just kind of on the fly. There have been lots of ways to play games, like tabletop games, online, and I really fell into those things when the pandemic happened. I didn't really do any online play before the pandemic, and I learned how to use several of the platforms quite a bit. That kind of became a secondary hobby to me, and I've actually tinkered around with making tutorials of how to use those things, using the skills and the things that I know already. And it's been interesting to do that, to like put yourself in that space. I do think that I have taught myself to be a teacher over the last 10 years, and I like that about myself. I guess I like teaching things. I like helping people through things, and I imagine if I was to stop making John Gets Games, it's very likely I'd find myself in a different situation where I was helping other people learn things to a certain extent, I guess.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's cool. What's like the you said that you kind of like from the digital formats and experiences, the things that you were learning, what's like one program or I'm sorry. What's one program or something that you learned that you are maybe like the most proud of that you thought was going to be like the most difficult and that you're able to like learn it and then help teach other people that as well.
I mean, the first one that I really started tackling was using Tabletop Simulator, which I think is probably the most known one. And like most people, I was absolutely bewildered by it when I first started. I was very clumsy, and it was a really interesting experience kind of learning it as it went. And I got into the coding side of it like a year into it or so. And I think one of the ones that I'm most proud of is I made a tabletop simulator mod for a game called Trick Takers, which is a surprisingly complex asymmetric trick-taking game where, you could play like the adventurer or the alchemist, and every single one of these has its own rule set. And I spent like 2 months building this scripted mod so that every single one of these was supported. It was, automated. As you put things down, it would know who won. It would know that the alchemist can play special cards over there, and the adventurer has its own custom deck that it would draw cards at the right time. And I really invested a surprising amount of time into that, even though I don't actually like the game very much. It's not a bad game. It's just not my preferred kind of game to play, but it was such a fun challenge, and it was really fun to release that and to know that other people were enjoying that as well. I've been a on again, off again, mostly off again, coder since like 1996 or so, making GeoCities and Fortune Cities websites and that kind of thing. And so it's always fun to kind of fall back onto that. I hadn't coded anything between the years of probably 2007 and 2022, and so kind of rekindling that part of my brain was extremely satisfying.
Oh, that's and I mean, I took a few years of computer science, and honestly, I probably should have committed more to it in high school because I don't know, it was high school. We'll just leave it at
I feel the same way, honestly.
that.
I took the computer science AP. I got a four, and that's the last computer class I ever took. And I loved it, but I was just like, I think programming is going to be a hobby of mine. I said this back in 2002. Like, oh, my life would be very different if I decided to get a computer science degree in college. But here we are.
Yep.
I don't have regrets. My life is amazing. So.
It's funny how, these things like ebb and flow and re-enter your life in different ways. But I'm not like I know TTS. I've like used it very sparingly, but I would have to imagine creating a fully like automated mod was quite the undertaking for
It was. It was intensely satisfying though. And I have a history of making things that I don't necessarily use. Like I remember back when I would make, websites in the late 90s. I would just make website after website that was completely barren of content. There was no content. There'd be like a menu structure. There'd be all these pages that were like, coming soon. And then the moment I finished building the graphic design and building the structure of it all, I'd want to take on a different one. So I just left a string of shell websites in my wake. And I've made a lot of board game online implementations that I've never actually played. It's a similar kind of thing. Like I just enjoy making them, I guess, more than actually committing to them to a certain extent.
That's cool. I mean, yeah, it seems extremely fair to me. Okay. So like the second like chunk is almost the inverse here. You have to pick three activities that you feel would not lend themselves well to a learn while doing style of tutorial.
That's interesting. I think I'm going to be hard pressed to come up with three, if I'm being honest.
Okay.
I just like
We'll take.
learning so much this way. I mean, I suppose, if you're, I mean, I don't have experience with this, but like, if you're getting I imagine a lot of degrees would make sense with this. Like, if you're trying to be a lawyer, you're gonna have to do a lot of book learning before you actually find yourself in court, like litigating something. I guess complex things like that would certainly make sense. Although I've never been to law school, maybe they do mock type things as well to kind of lock that kind of thing in. I think, honestly, I think it's largely a mistake to try and learn anything without doing it to a certain extent. And so I don't want to avoid the question. If I come up with something, I'll let you know. But I feel like even the examples that I might come up with, I'm like, I think they'd still probably be better if you had that context. We have so many inputs. Our brain can hold, handle so much, but I don't think this is how it actually works, but the way I think about it is you have a concept, and the more legs, the more connections and links you can add that concept to other things in your brain, the more likely it is to stick. Versus if you just know that, the sky is blue or something like that, that's like one connection as opposed to why. Or I mean, the concept, if you've never seen the sky and you're like, the told that the sky is blue overhead, if you ever left your house, you're like, okay, I get it. You might forget what the color of the sky is going to be if somebody asked you a week later without going out and actually seeing it, if that makes sense. So yeah, I've avoided your question. I'm sorry.
Hey, you know what? This is your interview. Your name's on it, so you can take it. That makes sense. I honestly, sometimes I ask questions and I don't have like any idea what I think a good answer would be. And this might have been one of them. I don't know. I don't know what I would. I honestly, like there. I'd probably say about 50% of the questions I come up with, I'm like, oh, I have like a really good thought for that. And another 50%, I'm like, ah, well, just I have no idea what I would
See
say.
what happens.
Let's just say I don't know. I was, yeah, I think that process of, experiencing and doing anything definitely will help. I was just trying to, I guess I was trying to think personally for an answer that was like almost like outlandish. It's like I don't know. That there could be like serious risk involved if you were like trying to make the tutorial in the first place almost, if that
Right.
makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, just even thinking like back to how we all start learning to a certain extent, maybe not start, but like school. I hated homework. Everybody hates homework, but homework is learning while doing. You are taught how to do math in class, and it means nothing to you unless you actually do some math, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I had a few shifts. I mean, I think it's funny. Like again, talking about high school, probably like high schools where people hate homework the most. But once I left high school and, did like post-secondary education, I don't know. I definitely fell in love with homework in a very weird way. Like I just like, took all my classes as seriously as I could and
That sounds very fortunate for you. I wish that had happened to me. Un unfortunately for me, when I got to college, a thing called World of Warcraft existed. So that made doing homework very difficult.
Well, I can't my very so freshman year, like I don't think I was like as an exemplary student, maybe like towards the end of freshman year as I could have been. For me, it was like flash games. Like I just fell down rabbit holes of playing like flash games online for
Newgrounds.com, right?
I don't even, I honestly couldn't even tell you. Like, I think I purged the
I spent
memory from.
a lot of time doing that as well. I will admit.
Oh, that's funny. But yeah, after that period, I was able to kind of fall into just studies and yeah, I guess I lucked out.
Well, it sounds like you were studying something that worked for your brain, and
Yeah.
that's important. I never enjoyed school, and I never enjoyed college, and I didn't really like the thing I got a degree in, and I think that was a bit of a mistake. I think if you actually care about what you are learning, you're going to learn it a lot better. Yeah.
Yeah, that's extremely true and that's very profound. So anybody listening going to school, make sure you're doing what you want and then you'll enjoy it more.
Yeah. Or at least give it at least try, right?
Yeah. No kidding. Okay, cool. We're kind of circling back like a little bit to some different things. So, we've talked a bit about your like the types of videos that you're creating, not necessarily like video creation processor or anything like that, but you've talked about design a little bit as well, but you do development work too.
Yes.
So do you just kind of want to outline some of the things that you're doing from like the a development side of board games right now?
Sure. It's something that I don't do that much, I will admit. I do enjoy it significantly. I mentioned in that in like 2010, 2011, I started trying to design games. And after a couple of years struggling with it, I realized I generally, at least back then for sure, preferred playtesting other people's stuff and giving feedback and working with them like on their designs and then letting them do the hard thing of like actually making prototypes and coming up with this the various the busy work to a certain extent that can come with design. Also the stress that can come with design of like trying to actually figure it out as opposed to just being a person that comes up with ideas. I've definitely done a bit of it over the last couple of years for a couple of publishers, and generally it revolves around them tossing me the game, and I read the rules, I mess around with it, I play it against myself. Sometimes I play it with friends, and then I give feedback. Essentially, try to pinpoint the pinch points, essentially, and the parts that maybe don't work, or the negative experiences, or the moments when people aren't as connected, and or the parts that are too complicated. I mean, honestly, my main focus when I'm doing any amount of development work is streamlining, because especially if I'm coming to a game that has been largely created by the designer, it's very easy to not kill your darlings. Like as a concept, that's something a lot of people know, is like you can have too many ideas and then it suffers overall. So generally when I come to games in this respect, I come with a machete and I try to figure out what can be axed essentially and still have a good game, because the barrier to entry, I think, for most games is the rule book and is the teach. I think a lot of games really struggle, especially these days. A lot of modern Euros have 30 plus page rule books because they have 50 different icons, and they have sub actions and free actions and interrupt actions, and they've got, eight different kinds of resources and all these things. And a lot of people love that stuff, and I'm not saying it's bad, but when I come to development, I try to see if I can get those eight resources down to six. Try to see if I can reduce the number of those free actions or the interrupts or the combos or the things that can really drag things down, because I think that makes the game more approachable, and it makes it more of a game that I want to play. And I guess that's the difficult thing about doing development, is you have to know where the game is supposed to go. For example, an unnamed game that I won't go into the specifics of, that I have experience of with very recently, is in a situation where it's being taken in a direction that I personally, I don't mind it, but I can tell that it's going in that direction because the target audience is different than me. I am not the target audience. And when I kind of put myself into that mindset, I was like, I get the designs that they've actually made. They make a lot more sense considering the direction they're going. Maybe that makes me a worse developer for that specific product. I like to think that I could try to put my head in those kind of concepts as well. But yeah, I mean, essentially, from what I can tell, again, as somebody who's not done it very much, development is playtesting and giving strong feedback, I guess, to a certain extent. And that's fun. Like, I really enjoy that kind of element. I mean, I started John Gets Games as a review channel, and honestly, one of the reasons I stopped making it, sorry, one of the reasons I stopped making reviews was because I frequently felt like I was standing in front of the barn with the doors wide open and the horse is long gone, and I'm like, that horse had problems. Sitting here like pointing out flaws in my opinion and rough points in my opinion. Like, in a lot of ways, my reviews felt like development notes. I feel like they felt like development notes for something that could not change anymore. And that got frustrating over after a certain amount of time. And I'm like, I would rather be in the industry and give these development notes when things can change. That's a much more satisfying thing than saying something is less good than it could be. It's way better to actually make the game better. Again, I have not done actually that much. I found it difficult to shift into these kind of things. Like everything, I think the more you do something, the better you get at it, and probably the more people you meet and the more connections you make and whatnot. But I've done a decent amount of game design over the last couple of years, and so I guess you're not really a developer on your own designs, but I've also become friends with a lot of other people that have been doing a lot of game design. In fact, I got credited as a developer on a game called Of What's Left, and I really appreciated that from my friend Taylor Renner, who you had on as a guest somewhat recently. And that felt really cool, you know, and a big part of the de quote unquote developer role that I had in that one was just talking, like humongous Discord direct message conversations, talking about it, mulling through things, and trying to come up with various solutions and whatnot.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, especially if it is like a more, recent like endeavor for you, and that it is kind of going hand in hand with some of your design work and just some of your connections that you do have. Like it seems like a cool thing, a neat thing to be working on, and taking all of your experience with playing a lot of games, with looking at a lot of rule books and seeing like that's kind of like your area. Like what's gonna stop people, or what's gonna hold people up from playing a particular game. Oh, I don't know. Just yeah, it seems like a cool spot where all those things connect. But you did mention design. You said you've been doing a good bit of design over the past couple of years, and if I'm not kind of mistaken, so if looking at like your design credits on BoardGameGeek, there are four games there, but the one that has had the widest release so far is Spring Cleaning.
Yes, it's pretty much the only one that has had any release, but yeah.
Very, very cool. And you did a video, a how to play, learning to play tutorial of your game. So how would you describe kind of like the process or your thoughts of feeling of being able to make a video for your own game?
I mean, it was fun. It was definitely an interesting experience to be like, these were all my choices. I will say that I felt more pressure to do it right. I filmed that video, and then I subsequently realized I had made a mistake like two-thirds the way through the video, and I refilmed the last two-thirds of the video because it's like I can't put out a video with a mistake in my own game. And the mistake wasn't rules. I just like accidentally discarded cards that I wasn't supposed to and that kind of thing. And I was like, well, you know, I want to show this game off in the best possible light because it's my baby. And so I did. I mean, it was definitely fun to do that for sure. And to say, you know, go check this thing out. I hope you enjoyed this. I always say that. I hope you enjoyed learning how to play this game, but like I really hope people enjoyed learning how to play that one because it's so close to me.
Yeah, it was funny. It was funny watching that one because, you mentioned it at the beginning. You mentioned why it was like kind of a special video because it was your game, and then you said that at the end as well. But kind of like the in between was still, like your video, just walking through the game, like playing the game, and then I don't know. It was fun like watching it and being able to like see that too. But I guess just like a quick follow-up question. Like a lot of the games that you do tutorials for, like you cover like a huge range of board games for sure. But I guess what do you think like some of the potential like tricks of describing or trying to like teach a card game might be compared to some of the more like Euro-y, like multi-step, like mid-weight stuff that I think is the majority of your work.
I mean, I have thought about this because I have covered some card games, trick takers, and that kind of thing on my channel, and I've worried about it at the start because so much of it is in your head and about like card counting and like the overall experience. Also, you know, to a certain extent, the social experience of chatting with people and whatnot. There's just a lot less stuff to look at, even if there's still a lot of things to think through. And sorry, I need to take a pause. My dog is losing its mind. I'll be right back.
Perfect.
Just edited out that quick pause.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries. I mean, That was Puffin from your game, correct?
Yes. Yeah, she's a very good guard dog. She's always telling us when anybody's walking out in front of the house.
Hey,
We definitely know.
she just needed to know she had to make an appearance on the video. That's all. You talking about my game? Oh, okay. But yeah, sorry. You were kind of talking about like some differences in thinking about like headspace of card games and.
Right, in the making of the videos. Yeah, it didn't end up being as hard, I guess, to do as I had worried it was going to be, because you can keep talking through various things. Yeah, like I said, the hardest part is a big part of these games is kind of keeping in your mind what has happened. And these videos generally take me a couple of hours to make. So I guess to a certain extent, I can cheat and look at various hands and figure out what's going on and stack the hands like, oh, I think it's important that this person loses right here and that kind of thing. But again, the thing I always tell myself when I start stressing about this is people are not watching my video for an authentic competitive experience. They're watching the video to learn and just to kind of see how the game could be played. So that's the thing I try to focus on.
Continuing with some de design work, you are going to be taking a game to Indie Games Night Market in just a few months
That's true, yeah. At PAX Unplugged.
at PAX Unplugged. Anything that you want to, I don't know, like how much you want to talk about that. Any notes on that game and kind of like
Well,
the.
this one's kind of a full circle for me. It's called Mutation, and I started designing it in 2010. When I talk about this is the only game that I consider to have actually completed from that couple of years of messing around with many different designs. There was another one that got pretty close. I've actually been meaning to come back to it after like 14 years. I'm like, I should poke at that. I think there was something there. But Mutation is a dice game, and it very much evolved out of my frustrations with working on other designs, primarily with prototyping. I think things are a little different now that so much is happening online, but that was not the case in 2010. And so there was a couple board games that I had that I was working on, like one sci-fi deck builder and one. I mean, everybody's trying to design deck builders back in 2010. And it was so frustrating to have to like rebuild everything for a new prototype, knowing that it was probably completely flawed and I have to rebuild it again and rebuild it again. And it was fatiguing and it was demoralizing. And I remembered sitting there at my desk and I was like, I'm going to get some dice. So I did, so some D6 dice. And I'm like, I'm going to come up with a game and it has a design constraint that it is only dice, because then all I have to do is iterate on the rules. I don't have to iterate on the components of this prototype. It's going to be dice. The number of dice might change, but it's going to be dice. So I actually went out to every single dollar store in the greater area, went to like $6 stores to buy up all their D6 dice, because you could get like for a dollar you could get like six dice, and it was a something like that, maybe eight dice. So I picked up like 150 dice by cruising to a whole bunch of dollar stores, and I just started working on it. And I remember having a bit of an epiphany like 20 minutes in to messing around with this, and it was a very refreshing experience because I was just rolling dice and just saying, what if this, what if that, roll dice, what if this, what if that. And then I started to have this idea of stacking dice on top that share the same number and trying to compete for various sizes. And the core of the gameplay emerged, at least the original core emerged, surprisingly quickly. In a lot of ways, it was one of those moments where I was like, does this exist already? It almost felt like I found the rules as opposed to coming up with them. And I worked with that one for a while back in 2010, 2011, and I considered it done. And I published the rules on Board Game Geek and I moved on. And then in 2017, like one day, I think I was in the shower and the game kind of came to me. I hadn't played it in years. I was just like, wait, what if that? And I don't go into the details of it, but like it was just one of these like lightning strike moments, because there was one element to Mutation, the first version, that frustrated me. I have some pet peeves in board game design, and they're pet peeves because I understand they can just be a thing that have to happen. But one of them is when something is because I say it is, and the reason for it is feels insubstantial to me. And for for Mutation, the first version, it's a dice stacking game. And when people stack the dice too high, they'd like fall over. Like it just didn't work. And so I came up with a limit. I said, you can't stack a fourth die. You know, three is the limit. And I hated that rule. It worked. It made the game work in a lot of ways. It presented a lot of interesting design space decisions because you put a die on the third level. It's pretty safe because you're not allowed to stack onto the fourth level. But it irked me for years and years and years. And then I, in 2017-ish, maybe 2018, I had this idea that organically created that rule. And I was so excited about it. I wrote a new rule book. I kind of considered that Mutation 2.0, even though it felt similar. Like when you play with the 2.0 rules, you almost never stack to the fourth space. So it, in reality, it's a very similar experience. You certainly theoretically could do a fifth space stack, but I've never seen it get even remotely close to that. And that was just a very rejuvenating feeling to be like, okay, cool. My one pet peeve, it exists, but it exists for a good reason now, as opposed to an arbitrary one. Like, well, why didn't you say four? Well, why didn't you say two? Now it's an emergent rule as opposed to being just, one that I kind of came up with. And I was really impressed with the game back then, and I taught it to some people. And it's interesting. It's a pretty polarizing game in a lot of ways because it's going after in two different groups of people in the worst way possible. And I've never wanted to like sign this game. I mean, it'd be fun if I did, but this game was designed for me, not to like have mass market appeal or anything like that. And the problem is that it's essentially an abstract game, like of stacking dice, putting dice around. You're trying to have a big cluster of dice, and it feels like, a game that would just be like wooden discs or something like that. But you roll these dice every single turn. So for people who really like abstracts, they're like, what are these dice doing in my abstract game? Abstract games, generally perfect information, no randomness, that kind of thing. But this game has a ton of randomness. But it's all about what do you do after that? You roll the dice, what decision do you have? And then the other th thing happens with people who love to roll dice, they're like, I don't like abstract games. This looks like an abstract game. Get this abstract stuff out of my fun dice rolling experience. So, it's not angling for a large market in any way. But just about a year ago, I dusted it off after like, 6, 7 years again, and gave it a shot, and had a conversation with some of the people I was playing with. The idea of using the Between Two Cities methodology of scoring emerged. This is a game where you're putting down various dice colors. I'm red, you're green. I want lots of red, you want lots of green, I want green to go away. And there are four colors in the game. And what if I was red, yellow, and you were red, green? And we both care about red, but it's a competitive game. I want red and, what I say, yellow to be good, and you want red and green to be good. So I might play red to be hostile against green, even though you also care about red. And this made the game more complex from a brain space perspective. It didn't really, I mean, the rule add was very simple, but finally I felt like, okay, this game is awesome now. Because, one of the biggest lingering problem I had, even from the 2.0 version, is it is a dice game. You could just get unlucky. You could just need to roll a four and go like five rounds and not roll a four, even though you roll two dice every single turn. Like, it's possible. And you might feel like you lose because of that. Frequently, it seemed like one person would just have a non-starter. Like, they just could not get the game going. And then they watched other people compete. And suddenly, when you share a color, that largely goes away. Like, you can, like, if red is really suffering and you and I both control red, odds are good your green is doing better than red and my yellow is doing better than red. Like, we need to focus on red, you and me. Let's work on red. We're much more likely to do good stuff with it. And also in this game, it's a mean game. You're stacking on top of dice. You can remove dice, and it feels a lot less punishing when somebody else removes a red die because it hurts you and me. It's not like, targeting me in particular, and I might be like, hey, I'm not even winning this game. And you're like, well, but your die was in a spot that I really want to go. And it's just, sharing the burden, sharing the lows and the highs is fun. I mean, my favorite kind of game, generally speaking, is team games because I like competing. And I also like having a buddy that I can, like, again, share these highs and lows with. And so it turned this game into a semi-cooperative game. It's still fully competitive. Only one person is going to win. But, I've now seen situations where one person is just getting lucky. They're getting the right dice rolls. And the other people around the table are like, well, let's band together. Suddenly it becomes a bit of a two-on-one. And that can counteract the luck in a lot of ways. And then the question is, when does it stop becoming a two-on-one and become a 1v1v1 again? Because they also want to win, so that is a temporary alliance in a lot of ways. And I just love that kind of stuff. So essentially, this is Mutation 3.0. And I think all of these games are fully playable. I think all these games are fun. I've played them dozens and dozens of times. I've played the 1.0 rules more than all the rest of them for sure. But I finally feel like it's done enough to do something. And in a lot of ways, spring cleaning has given me the confidence to actually print this game. Like a very small, very, very small number of these. I'm kind of doing this by myself. I'm going to be assembling them in our house. We're probably going to make like 50 copies. So like this is calling it a publishing a game feels like maybe even a misnomer. But I'm excited about it. I'm excited to finally bookend this thing that started so long ago. 14 years ago, and finally saying this is done, and certain people who care about it can actually try it out. It's exciting. It's always been a lingering thing, essentially in the back of my head.
You're gonna get a really stupid response from me. I listened to all that really like thoughtful chat from you, and my number one thought was one could say that mutation has mutated.
It certainly has. It certainly has. I mean, every design does, but it definitely leans into that. I mean, it's a generic name. It honestly shocks me that no game had been called that. I was like, okay, it's a pretty simple name, but it's about, like hypothetically, like bacteria in a petri dish, growing and eating each other and, mutating their DNA and all that. I mean, it's an abstract game with D6 dice, but for a theme, I think it works out well enough. Yeah.
Has I guess like the one question I have. So like obviously it kind of spawned from you giving yourself a component limit. Like this is what I have, this is what I'm working with. Have the dice changed much, or have you kind of kept the same numbers, or has that slightly been tweaked, or
The dice counts definitely changed. The first version was 20 dice per color, so it was 80 dice in the game. I think one of the very first versions was 25 dice per color. I mean, that's a lot of dice. That is a mountain of dice, and that's part of the reason I never really actively thought I could like get this game signed or something like that. Like a publisher is just going to laugh me out of the room because dice are expensive and they are heavy. Like two things that are going to make cut your margins down significantly, and that's fine because this is just my own little pet project. It's essentially been the dice count. Like it's now down to 15 dice per player. And that big change happened with the 2.0 version. In the original version, you just took 19 turns and then the game was over. Now there's a relative amount of time and dice come back into the pool. I essentially got to reuse them. Whereas before, dice were removed and they were just gone. Now, if you remove a red die, it goes back into our pool for us to roll. And it essentially let me get 20 dice worth of value with only 15 dice, being able to actually reuse components. And the number of times that I've shown this to somebody or told somebody about it, and they're like, well, I bet you could make it work with cardboard tokens. Like that would make it a lot simpler. Is high. Like probably dozens of people have told me that. And every single time they like play it and they're like, oh yeah, that wouldn't work. These have to be dice. Like, yeah, I know. I know. I mean, I could really change the game, but then I think it would lose its soul in a lot of ways. It'd be just a different game. Probably a fun game could happen with a lot of these rules, but I don't know. I think it kind of needs to be dice. And it has that really cool table feel because you're stacking dice on top of it as well. I back then, my design ethos and my board game taste ethos was that I did not like victory points. Like that was a thing that really went through my head a lot in 2010, 2011. It's one of the reasons I love Tuluva so much is because it's a condition-based game. I liked working towards conditions as opposed to I have 125 points and you have 132 points and you win. I've come around to enjoying those kind of games more as life has gone on, but I really enjoyed that kind of condition. And in a lot of ways, Settlers of Catan is like that as well. I mean, sure, there are victory points, but it's the first to seven. Like, it's so small, it feels more like a condition, and the game ends when you hit a certain amount of it, which is just different. And so, my dice game, I guess to a certain extent you could call it points, but at the end of the game you just count up the size of these things and the biggest size wins. You could say that size is victory points, I suppose, but that was definitely the kind of angle that I was going for. Essentially not point salad. Not because I thought the point salad idea was bad, it was just not really what I was looking for at the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, obviously you could probably break down a lot of win conditions to points,
Yeah.
but it's a very, in this case, it's a very singular means of points. So,
Yeah, exactly.
oh, cool. Well, I'm excited to hear about that and see how that goes, and excited for people to play Mutation 3-0 in this very
I think a lot of
limited.
people are going to bounce off it, and that's fine. That's one thing that I've thought about. I've shown this to a lot of people. In fact, some of my friends recently, and some of them had thoughts like, "Oh, what if you did this? What if you did that?" And my main rebuttal is, "I don't want to." Like some of these ideas might make the game better, but I'm like, you know what? This is my own little thing, and I'm just going to make it for me. And feel free, like, try that. Like, if people house rule this game, I'm overjoyed. Like, go nuts. Like, make the game what you want. But for this one, I've decided to be selfish and not target any particular market. Just make the game that I think I want it to be.
Yeah, I mean, kind of ties into like one of your earlier points from the video, and like making the videos that you wanted to see. Now you're making the game that you want to play, and it
Yeah.
is in this weird cross section. But no, that's fantastic. I, for the sake of your time, I'll get to like I got kind of just two quick wrap up questions, and one of them ties pretty well into our pre recorded conversation. And my penultimate question is always just asking a guest or guests what is a text that has been stuck on their mind. So this could be anything that you've been reading or watching or playing that's really like stuck around with you that you've been thinking about a lot.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I historically I've been a reader. Like I read a lot as a teenager, like mostly hard sci-fi and that kind of thing. I kind of fell away from it in my 20s, and I've come back to it in a way and back to it in a way. And over the last like year or so, I've really fallen into audiobooks because I walk a dog every single day for 2 miles. And so that's like an hour of my day that I'm just kind of just walking the same route that I do every single day. And I realized like I could be reading at this time. Actually, I remember 14 years ago or so, back when I worked a very different job 15 years ago, I would read, like physically read a paperback book while commuting, and I'd just be walking across the city of San Francisco. Like I get to a crosswalk and look up, and then get across the crosswalk and look down and just read while walking. And it's amazing how many times I did not run into poles or various other people because I was just so stuck on these books. And I've actually been rereading that series. That's been really what's been on my mind. It's a series called Malazan, and it's actually a fantasy series. It's not sci-fi in any way. I've kind of come around to fantasy in a lot of ways over in my adulthood, whereas as a teenager it was just hard sci-fi. That's all I cared about. And this series is pretty phenomenal. It's gigantic. It took me like 3 years to read the 10 book series the first time around. Each book is longer than the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy, so it's big. Every book has just dozens and dozens and dozens of characters. One of my favorite things about this book series, actually, is at the start of each book, there is a list of all the characters that are going to be in the book. It's at the very beginning of the book, not at the end. And with like a really brief description, like, there's a character called Traveler, and the description might be like, a man found walking on a trail or something like that, like something really vague. And then later on, like 6 books later, you realize, oh my God, Traveler's X and Y. And then it's like, oh, Traveler actually, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, what? Really, really cool things like that. And one of my favorite parts as I got deeper into this series, again, it's 10 books long. I mean, there's like 25 books now, but like the core series is 10 books long, is I'd get into like book 6 or 7. And I would be so excited. The first thing I do is read the entire list of the characters so that I could get pumped up to see which characters are actually in it. Like, oh my gosh, this character hasn't been in three books. I'm so excited. Like, my favorite character is back. And that would just like pump me up in a lot of ways. At the same time, I remember being like in book eight, and then like halfway through the book, I start a new chapter, and oh my gosh, it's 12 new characters because it's a new, like, combat unit in the military, and they all have their own names, and I'm just like, oh, there's too many names. But I really enjoy it. It's just a really epic in scope series. I guess it's been described as military fantasy. I'm not generally like a military person. I don't play war games or any of that kind of stuff, but I think I like the series in spite of the fact that most of the main characters are commanders and soldiers and whatnot. But it tells a fascinating, surprisingly brutal story in a lot of ways. I'm rereading it and I'm kind of like, wow, I don't remember it being this this bloody in a lot of ways. But it's actually been really interesting experiencing these books a second time along in audiobook form, because these books are gargantuan, and I own all of them, and I've read them once before, like I said. But it's hard not to skim. Like, it's really hard not to skim. Like, you get to a new section and you're like, oh, I don't care about this character that much, and you just kind of like cruise down the page. And you can't really skim when you're listening to an audiobook. Like, it's just coming to you in the rate that it's coming. I mean, your mind can wander, but it doesn't fast forward you. Like, sometimes I'm like, I want to get back to the chapter with the characters I want. Let's just get through this. And so I'm picking up a lot more about the story in audiobook form, and I'm forcing myself to listen to it at 1x speed. Like, I consume almost all my media at 2x speed, but the audiobook is one, because I'm like really forcing myself to like pay attention. Like, if I'm going to listen to 10 40-hour long audiobooks, I should commit to it. And that being said, I'm walking the dog and my brain starts wandering to games or something else. I'll frequently stop and be like, I'm going to fast forward about 3 minutes or rewind. I'm going to rewind about 3 minutes to listen to that section again, because I think something really big just happened. Actually, I had that experience with the very first book in this series. It was strongly recommended to me by a coworker, and I bought it and I started reading it. And I remember I was like 100, 150 pages in, 120 pages, and I was just not in. I was like, this is boring and it's going nowhere, and I'm just so confused. And I was like, you know what? It was strongly recommended by a coworker. I'm going to give it another try, and I'm not going to skim. I'm going to read every single word. And the second time I got like 100 pages in, I was just reeling. I was like, this book is amazing. So much awesome stuff is happening. And I just completely missed it the first time because I wasn't committing to it. And I guess, some media, some books, you just flip the pages, right? You just like bang, bang, bang. It's super engaging, and then you get through it. And other things like this, like, you have to commit. And I'm not always down for that. Like, between each of these books, I read something that's much lighter. That's a lot easier to kind of like breeze on through. But no, I've definitely been enjoying coming back to it. I actually, as an Easter egg, squeezed these into my Gloomhaven video, which is my best video. Like, it's got the most views of anything that I've made by a long shot. And every like month or two, somebody will comment like, oh my gosh, you like Malazan. I'm like, yeah, you noticed that, eh? Like, all of the characters in that video are named after some of my favorite characters in that show, in that book series. I've done that and other times. I did a video for a game called Your Best Life last year, and I put the names of a book at the time that I was just loving, called Children of Time. I put those in there as well. Most people didn't notice that, but they're actually the names of sentient spiders.
Oh.
It was a sponsored video. I don't think the publisher realized I was putting sentient spider names into their game about living your life and having kids and stuff. But hey, it tickles me, I guess.
Those are fun touches. So just for the audio series, this is just like a clarification. For the books, do they go through that character list when you're listening to the
They
beginning?
don't. They don't. That's a little bit of a bummer. I will admit that
Okay.
I kind of lose out on that. I understand why, because I
Yeah.
think that list is supposed to be there when you start a chapter and you're like, who the heck is Korlat again? There's Korlat, and there's Kalor, and there's Caladan, and there's Coltane. Like, all of these are actual characters that you get in the first the books two and three, and you're just like, wait a second. Coltane versus Kalor, very, very important differences. And so you can look at the list at the front and kind of like figure that out. And it might sound like that's a lot of character names with K at the beginning, but that's just because there's so many characters.
Yeah. Yeah, it might not be the best like listening experience. Like, oh, here's book five and here's 50 characters that you're
Yeah,
gonna hear. But
exactly.
awesome. Well, the final bit then is, we talked about spring cleaning a little bit. You've got Mutation coming at Indie Games Night Market. Obviously, you're gonna keep making videos.
Yeah.
Anything, and then also just like a note too that if anybody listening hears spring cleaning, we didn't really even like talk too much about. We mentioned that it's a card game,
Yeah,
but
glossed over it a bit.
yeah,
It
but.
is it is still up for order. A lot of people. I kind of hate to do this, but whatever. I'm going to do it. A lot of people describe it as Scout adjacent. It was not designed to be Scout adjacent. It kind of wandered into that direction. I love Scout, so it's not too surprising. But yeah, it's a game about trying to play all your cards. It's got cute artwork of our dog on it, and the main conceit is actually once again like kind of a shared space where you're trying to play all your cards, but some of your cards are face up in front of you, and other people can play those cards for you, which might make you happy, or maybe it'll make you sad because you need those cards. And so you frequently have that decision of, do I play other people's cards for them to help myself because I'm also helping them? And that's one of my favorite things in gaming in general is when good stuff happens to me when it's not my turn. Sometimes bad stuff as well. Somebody takes
Yeah.
my nine. I'm like, I desperately needed that nine. But I like it when things happen to me when it's not my turn that change my decision space, as opposed to like being attacked or something like that, because it keeps me vested, as opposed to like I take my turn, then I just my brain wanders or something like that. In this game, frequently people are placing cards in front of them that anybody can use. So your hand of cards and your options and the things that you can do changes constantly, which keeps you engaged, right? Like I at least I like to think that it keeps people engaged. And I will say that like my design ethos has changed. Like I said, back in 2010, it was like victory points are not what I want. I want conditions. These days, my design ethos is very much on shared incentives. I mean, in general, like I'm not going to go off on a train game rant here, but like I love train games and stocks and all that kind of stuff. And in a lot of ways, spring cleaning has that as well. You have this shared experience where, like, there's a couple threes out there. Who's going to take them? What's going to happen? And you can have situations where somebody's about to play all their cards, and so other people collude and like play a straight out slowly in their cards in front so that somebody can play it to beat the person that's about to go out because we all need to work together to stop them from going out. And yay, we stop them from going out. Okay, now we hate each other again. Now we're all going at each other's throats. I love that decision space of let's work together until we need to stop working together, and when does that moment happen? And not because it feels like I enjoy betraying people or something like that. I like it when it's situations where like, it's like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. It's time for us to kind of go our separate ways as opposed to like stabbing somebody in the back or whatnot. And that's definitely been where my brain has been sitting. Like I'm idly working on several other designs at this point that are very, very, very not done, but they're mostly just ideas at this point, and they are all in the shared incentive space. That's my favorite kind of game right now. Shared incentives, shared play spaces, where you're looking out into the middle of the table between everybody more than you're looking at like a personal tableau or something like that.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. You mentioned there are copies that are still available through New Mill Games right now, and
Yeah,
people
there's
are
like
listening.
around 100 copies. It depends on when you're listening to this,
Okay,
but
yeah.
yeah, we made 600 copies total, and about 500 of them have sold. And so, yeah, at some point it'll sell out, and
It will.
we're not going to make more spoilers. I mean, this is it. So I hope that people who get it enjoy it.
Yeah, I've been playing a little bit of a dangerous game. I kind of wanted to wait until the October releases to grab some games together.
Yeah,
But
there's some really exciting stuff that New
I
Mill
know.
is putting out on their pre-order. And like honestly, I'm hoping that that will lead to selling a bunch more of spring cleaning. I imagine now that it's getting good reviews and people are talking about it a little bit more because the first wave has gone out. I like to think that'll happen. And I don't begrudge anybody for doing that.
I can. Well, for me, it was just like I just me. It's like a clumping order thing, especially at this
Yeah.
point in time when I got like 10 billion games. But I have played a good amount of it on Board Game Arena,
Oh,
and I,
really? Oh,
oh yeah,
cool.
and I can 100% attest to any positive review that's come out about it. I'm kind of obsessed, and like. I know I'm gonna get a copy, so maybe me just being like waiting is stupid, but nonetheless,
Nah,
it's
you'll be fine. A
okay.
little insider info. It's not flying off the shelves right now. I think you'll be fine till October.
Well, okay.
Don't
Well,
blame me if I'm wrong, but yeah.
I won't. I mean, no matter what, I'm going to get my hands on a copy, so I'm not like super worried. But yeah, anybody listening to this, go check this out. And if it's a future where there are no more copies, go play it online and you'll have a great time. And then they'll just make you more excited to play any other future designs from you as well. Perfect. Well, this has been a lot. I appreciate your time, and I just had a really fun time. So
That's lovely. Thanks for having me on.
all right, thank you. Well, have a fantastic day.
Intertextual Cardboard Experience, the most cleanly podcast about board games and any other text that they connect to. Thank you so much for choosing to spend your time here. Any further support, such as sharing the show with friends, following the page's socials in the episode description, writing a review, filling out the feedback form, or doing anything else you can think of is greatly appreciated. Keep playing, watching, reading, listening, experiencing.